Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
So, Senator Morgan McGarvey and I went for a long time, and my system requires me to break this one up into two parts. So, our conversation lasted like an hour and 36 minutes. So this is part two. We pick up where we left off. We were talking about the free market and whether that might bring solutions to some of the issues that we see out there. So let's get back into the conversation, starting with that part of the discussion. This is part two of Senator Morgan McGarvey on the Disruption Zone.
And you talk about it in a free market perspective. I may be going, this is the great thing about a podcast instead of radio, is we can go down these tangents.
Sure.
There's a great little thing I heard. I'll send it to you as well. It's like 3 or 4 minutes, right? But it's a guy who is explaining game theory and using it as an analogy to what we experience now. So you talk about free market. He said, okay, take a game, right? And you've got three color tokens, red, blue, and green. And you have two blue, two red, two green. You put them in a bag, mix it up, right? And you pull one at random. Whatever it is, equal chance green, equal chance red, equal chance blue. Mm-hmm. And whichever token you pull, you get to then do an action for the game, right, that corresponds with that color. And then you get to put in an extra one of those tokens into the bag. So if your first draw, you pull a blue, you do a blue action, you put an extra blue token in the bag. Now you have three blue, two red, two green.
Okay.
Right. So for your first 20 to 30 times or so, just mathematically speaking, you can vary kind of widely in percentage of tokens for each color. But by the time you get up and you've done this 30, 40 times, all of a sudden the values are set. And if you're at 50% blue and 30% red and 20% green chances, pretty much that's how it's going to be going forward. Because even if you pull a green piece, you are going, that one green piece isn't going to offset the percentages all that much. There's still a much higher chance. And again, as this plays out mathematically, it just becomes more and more
stable. Is that supposed to be an analogy of the free market?
Well, more and more stable. And actually, this is what economists use sometimes when they talk about market share, right?
Okay.
And what this guy says is if you have 60% of whatever market, he says
right.
The chocolate chip market,
right?
Then all of a sudden your product is front and center and there's more of it on the shelf space. And sure, could it change? Yes, but not without great effort and not without great sentiment.
But that's what, the free market gives us the ability to do great effort. Like, I don't think your analogy doesn't necessarily hold up. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Those
I should listen all the way through.
I would listen all the way through the analogy before saying it doesn't hold
right,
up.
Right, sure.
That's me. Those are fair rules applied fairly that yield an unfair result.
I disagree.
Right? Now, okay, well, you can disagree. You can say that's the natural consequence. What if the rules were never fair in the first place?
Okay, go ahead.
And that's where we find ourselves.
Okay, no, see, I mean, okay, I see where you're going, okay, and...
Right, you see where I'm going?
I mean,
because
we're in a country
where we had slavery, where we had Jim Crow, we had a Chinese Exclusion Act, we had Japanese internment camps. If you were a woman, you could not have a credit card in your own name until the 1970s.
Right.
We had unfair rules applied by bad actors.
Right, but we do not have those rules now. And the idea
but
that...
But the game stabilized. And that's what I'm saying. So now when you look, you're still going to have a whatever percent chance of pulling from it. And
the game is not stabilized. The game is not stabilized, though, because you have what exists now that keeps those structures in place is crony capitalism. That's not capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's not free market. That's not, I mean, and I think this is where we arrive at the interesting difference between our two worldviews, which I think is mm-hmm. part of what's making this conversation fascinating to me. And that is that my friends on the left seem, or at least I will just say that you seem to be looking at the world from a standpoint that there's a finite amount of the pie. And once those pie pieces have been divvied up, that's it. There's nothing left. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't at the table, when the pie was first served. And that's a true statement. There are people in our society now that were not at the table when the pie was first served. And that was unfair. Okay, this is where you and I agree, right? When the pie was
even half eaten, right?
They didn't get any of the pie. They got the crumbs if there was anything left over, right? They were like me when I was a kid, licking the spoon that mom had left over after the cake was made, right? That's all I got. I totally get that, and I totally agree. There were people that are alive today that were not able to be at the table when the pie was served. What has changed is now we can all go make our own pies. Okay, because those rules have changed, thank God. And those barriers are out of the way. And I want to see us flood those areas with opportunity, because I want people to catch up. I want people to be able to be at the table now, okay? Everybody at the table. But in the free market, we don't just have pie at the table. We have turkey, and we have stuffing, and we have green beans, and we have casserole, and we have beets, and we have all these different things, and everybody's bringing all this stuff to, that's the free market. So, you know, I understand you're talking about an analogy that sometimes talks about how business works on Wall Street, but that's not the same thing as necessarily free markets. So we have changed the rules now, and now there's it's just like in 1970, could anybody have ever imagined needing an iPhone? What do you say about market share when Apple comes on the market share? I mean, you know, this is an invention that a guy told us, hey, you need this. And we listened to him and we went out and got it. We had no idea before the iPhone came along that anybody ever needed an iPhone. Now everybody has one or some equivalent of it of the other brand, because everybody else had to catch up. In other words, there's no cornering the market. We don't always have to serve pie. Sometimes we can serve cake and we can serve all these other things. And that's the free market. So I want the free market unleashed so that everybody can go make their own baked good. Now I'm hungry.
So
now I want pie.
So a couple of interesting things you said. One, I will say I actually don't view the pie as finite. I do view the pie as growing, or even other desserts.
Right.
I mean, I do view that. Of course, where my analogy was going is that even though the pie is growing,
it's not growing proportionately. Right.
It's not growing proportionally because of the way it was initially baked.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. Right? And I understand that.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's where I come from. That game theory analogy is we have to recognize that not everyone is getting their fair share today.
Right. Okay.
Even if you think the rules are applied
fairly
today,
right,
that we are still catching up from redlining, that we are still catching up from economic oppression, that we are, I mean, systemic racism from, you know, you talked about some of the police reforms we need, things that are happening. You know, I've never had to worry when I get in my car and go for a drive that I'm going to get pulled over for something silly.
Right.
Right. You know, I mean, this is, there are different realities. So I do agree with you. That's kind of where I was going with that.
No, and I think we're, again, we arrive at that place where we both agree on the problem, maybe not entirely on the solution.
Right.
But we both agree on the problem. I totally get that. And I want to solve that, right? I want to see everybody be able to have an equal opportunity, not equal outcomes. Because sometimes when you guys talk on the left, you start talking about equal outcomes. I'm like, you can't do that. You can't force equal outcomes. That's the ultimate in unfairness. Because no person is equal to other people. You and I are not equal. We are entirely different. You're a much better senator than I would ever be. But I'm probably a better radio host than you would ever be. You know what I mean? It's like, we're not equal. We don't have equal skills.
No,
but equal opportunity. Yes. You know, you know it. And so I totally do understand what you're saying. I do not have, I'll say what you said. I don't have all the answers to that. I believe the answers lie in the free market. You believe that that the answers might lie in some sort of adjustment of the free market. We're going to disagree on that, but I'm willing to hear it out, because I think, like you said at the beginning, if we don't have these conversations, we never get anywhere. We just go to our camps.
You know, the other interesting thing you said, that's why I think we need to unleash the free market. I think we're going to agree that we want capitalism.
Right.
You're both going to agree. We want capitalism.
Yeah, you're not a socialist. I know that.
But implicit in your statement is that the free market doesn't truly exist right now.
That's 100% true. It does
not.
And
that And that is, we've talked about it already today. We've talked about it with farming and farm subsidies. We've talked about it with housing. I mean, we said, and I won't go into it because we said we wouldn't, and it's a 5-hour discussion. Healthcare.
Right.
If you think there is a free market in healthcare,
no.
I am willing to have that debate
no,
with
there
anyone,
is not.
Any place, anytime.
No, there is not. There is not.
And I'm confident you and I probably have different solutions to that.
Right.
I'm pretty confident in that. But again, I mean, we can start in a place of agreement right there.
Well, I'm only going to hurry this up because I only have a certain amount of time that my website actually holds a certain number of megabytes, and I'm getting close to it. So I wanted to actually do the point that we wanted to start on. And that was,
wait, how far are we in now?
We're 54 minutes in.
We're going to get to the spot.
It's probably going to end up being a 2-part episode. So we'll just do with that, but that's fine. But, quickly, and I don't want to brush over this topic because we do find, I think, agreement here. You and I talked about this early on. I am, one of the few compliments I have to the mayor of Louisville is the banning of no-knock raids until further notice, until we figure all this out. I think I come from a standpoint of there's some low-hanging fruit in police reform. I believe most police officers get up every morning, they want to keep their community safe, and they want to go home safe to their family, and they are not trying to oppress people. However, I do believe that there are bad apples that get in the system, and that the system often doesn't do enough about those bad apples. The guy who killed George Floyd, his record was so long in being an abusive cop. There was no earthly reason why that guy should have been on the force at all.
That's right.
There should have been stop gaps. There should have been ways to weed that out. So I fully am on board with new and innovative ways of training for more community policing, more community involvement. So there's some low-hanging fruit there. One of them, though, I think no-knock raids, unless it's for a violent, potentially terroristic situation, they put the officer in danger, they put bystanders in danger, and they put someone who is often guilty of, if anything, a non-violent crime in unnecessary danger. And I know you agree with that, and we're trying to get that changed.
I agree.
Right?
Agree 100%, and I think we'll do that on the state level too. I mean, look, regardless of what you think about any facts of any circumstance or whatever, I mean, everything you said, we've got to get rid of no-knock warrants. They are not a good policy, and particularly, I think people are going to hate the minutia of this. But what was served was a no-knock evidentiary warrant. They were just looking for evidence, right? I mean, they weren't looking for a person who was. I'm saying they weren't gonna arrest a person who was there, but they weren't looking for what you were describing, the hostage situation,
right.
Or you know, imagine the worst circumstance. That's not even what the warrant was for. It's just for evidence.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, wouldn't we all rather have had I'm not commenting on Breonna Taylor's situation because I have not seen the investigative file.
No, but there's a lot of different information out there, and I think we're wise to stay away from the specifics of it just because that changes with the case.
I will talk all day long about that if we want. I'm not saying we're talking about no-knock warrants generally. I just want to get people focused generally on no-knock warrants.
Agreed.
The Breonna Taylor situation, while terrible and tragic and awful, we cannot undo. We have to make sure it can't happen again.
Yeah.
Right? So let's say that you have a no-knock warrant for drugs, which is what it was in that situation. Wouldn't you rather, at the end of the day, a bag of drugs get flushed down a toilet than somebody lose their life because of a bad policy?
1,000 times yes.
Right. And that's what what I say is people who've done horrible. I mean, Charles Manson died in prison. Right. He was arrested and tried.
Right.
You know, we've got, like you said, the no-knock warrants, they protect no one. Mm-hmm. And they're more dangerous for the people involved and more dangerous for the officers. It's a policy we got to get rid of.
And I think especially when you're talking about nonviolent drug crimes, I have a friend who's a former cop in a very big city, and he's a former SWAT guy. And I introduced him to another friend the other day. I said, this is my friend, his former SWAT, you know, such and such PD. And he gets up, and we were speaking at an event, and he gets up and he goes, my name is so-and-so, former PD. What I always like to tell people is I'm a veteran of the drug war, and we lost.
Wow.
The point that he's making is, you know, it was a big portion of his life that he spent going after people, and he's like, yeah, we lost. It's over. I mean, it's, you know, I not to get into a discussion about drugs, but the point is, yes, I would 1,000 times. Yes. I'd rather it get flushed down the toilet than, than somebody
dead. Somebody lose their life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or, and again, in the Breonna Taylor situation,
or a police officer lose their life.
And an unarmed woman shot dead in her apartment for no apparent, I mean, she's an unarmed woman shot dead in her apartment. There can't be an apparent reason why that happens.
Right.
And then you have a police officer who's been shot.
Right.
So you have, I mean, you have two people because, and this is something we
you're also in an apartment complex where bullets can go through walls. You could have had bystanders.
Oh, God. It's,
you know, there could have been any number of bad situations come from that.
You talked about the George Floyd situation. I mean, one of the police officers who was at Breonna Taylor's apartment that night had a record a mile long, including going back to the early part of the 2000s when the Lexington police office didn't rehire him. And what did he do? He came down and got hired on at Metro.
Right.
And so, you know, those are the types of things that you hear.
That's
all
one of the low hanging fruit, I think, of police reform is like some sort of a system that says this was, they can, an almost like a database where they can check. Because you hear about this all the time. Somebody gets in trouble in a big city and then they just go to a small city and they just reenact it there. And it's like, you know, there should be some sort of a system where they can go to this database and be like, oh, you were at, sorry. you know what I mean? Like, it's like,
if I applied for another job, so my day job is as a lawyer. As a senator, I actually am available to public recall where they can know everything about me. But in my private job, I'm a lawyer.
Right.
And, you know, if I had an ethics violation or a bar violation or something like that, where I've been found, I couldn't just go apply somewhere else.
Right.
And not have that question get asked. So, I mean, that's we got to have a civilian review board that has some real teeth.
Yeah.
That can actually do some things. We've got to, you know, you look at the chokehold practice. I talked to police officers actually a lot because the state police is in Frankfort and they are there to help, you know, protect the legislature and the governor and all that sort of stuff. State police are around all the time. And we find ourselves sitting in rooms, we'll talk. I mean, I've had some state police officers tell me, you know, that you shouldn't use a chokehold unless deadly force would otherwise be authorized.
Mm, yeah.
Right. They're just, it's a deadly, because chokeholds, I mean, we passed a law on this that makes strangulation a felony.
Right.
Because when you start to apply pressure to someone's, I mean, real pressure to someone's neck, bad things can happen and they can happen quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't know what kinds of pre-existing conditions, like with the George Floyd case, they might have.
That's right.
I think the same thing with Eric Garner in New York. Didn't he have a pre-existing condition? You put him in a chokehold. And that was another story that I just, this guy's selling cigarettes illegally on the street. Come on, man. You're going to put this guy in a chokehold and kill him for that? You know, it's just ridiculous. You know,
better training, better policies, because bad policies can lead to bad policing.
But on the flip side, I do want to say this because I support law enforcement. Because again, I firmly believe, I know too many law enforcement guys. I mean, these are the best guys in the world, man. They do not want to oppress somebody. And I think one of the problems that we have is we're not having people like you and me are not coming together, having these conversations, finding this agreement where we're like, yeah, there's low hanging fruit here that I think a lot of cops will agree with. We can do these things and it will help. Versus, well, let's just defund the police, right? Like Seattle is literally getting ready to disband their entire police department. Minority communities in Seattle who've been targets of hate crimes are coming forward going, you're leaving us vulnerable. You know, I mean, it's, and what's going to end up happening when you demonize the police is only, and I told somebody this the other day, this is a very big concern of mine. You know, there's most police are what I would consider to be sheepdogs. They're guys who are just born to protect. You know what I mean? Guys and gals. They were just born to protect. They're mama bears and daddy, you know, they were just born to protect. That's what they do. And then you have these people that are a small percentage, but they exist. They just love that authority. They're the hall monitor in grade school, and they just love that authority. You're going to be left with only those guys because no one else, the good people that are born to protect, are going to be like, screw it. I'm not putting my family's livelihood on the line because I could be falsely accused of something or I'm going to be berated in the public square. You're going to be left with only the guys that actually do like those authoritarian things. It's going to become a self-fulfilling philosophy if we go down that road.
Well, you talk about cost and low-hanging fruit. Here's an example of cost and low-hanging fruit coming together, right? Here's our Venn diagram. One thing that I think we should do, and I've heard a lot of people support, is that we should require body cameras to be on and be on every officer in almost every situation. Right. I mean, there's going to be some undercover work and stuff where we're going to have trouble getting that done.
I agree with that. Just do not. There are people that are wanting to do it live or to give access to people to that.
Right.
I do not want that because you could have serious Fourth Amendment violations when a cop comes into your home on a welfare check. And you could have stalkers if they can access that information. So, yes, as long as it's only accessible for, specific reasons.
And I hadn't even heard that. So there you go.
Yeah.
But I mean, just talking about general body cameras, but people don't appreciate the huge cost of body cameras. It's not the camera, right? The camera itself is not crazy expensive, not cheap, but I mean, it's not cheap when you talk about doing it for every police officer in a state or a city. But it's what you talked about already on this podcast of, I only have so many megabytes available on my website to store the information on those body cameras. If you have them running, which you should have them running, to store that information and then to keep it for a certain amount of time, which we absolutely must do.
Right.
We should have it. We should keep it so people can review it. That storage cost is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an example of a police reform I think we should have. That police reform in and of itself is going to cost money.
Right. Yeah. I think too, a lot of here's where it's like, this is one of the things you mentioned earlier about President Trump not handling COVID the best right now. Here's another area where I have a strong criticism of him. After George Floyd was killed, if I were president, I would have gotten on a plane and I would have gone to Minneapolis that day, or within a couple of days. And I would have been like, we got to fix this. And sat down and talk with the stakeholders. Again, might be a conversation like you and I where we've butted heads a couple times today. But I'd still go have that conversation, right? Because I want to understand what is the perspective of your community when something like this happens, right? That never happened. And I think we would have probably avoided a lot of the violence and the stuff, the strife we've seen this summer, if that had happened. It was even just being seen caring,
Mm-hmm. Well, he has handled so many things poorly. I mean, this is another 5-hour conversation, but I mean, these are moments that we're in right now that require a leader, that require an American president who, again, we're not going to always agree.
No.
But is trying to bring people together and be a healer and be there for the country. I'll give you an example. I mean, because look, I'm a Democrat, so a lot of your listeners can probably just dismiss everything I had to say about Donald Trump, and that's fine.
I trust my listeners. They will listen. Maybe not the Donald Trump stuff, but they're going to take into account. They may not agree with you on what you've said today, but they're going to listen to it. They're smart people.
But I point you to, and I've said this publicly before too, going back to the Bush years. I think it was a day or two after September 11th, and he stood on top of a rubble pile with a megaphone and put his arm around the fire and police people in New York City, which I don't know if they were Democrats and Republicans, but probably a good chance in New York City of a New York City fireman being a Democrat.
Right.
That's
can you imagine what the response would have been in this country if there had been a moment like that where if Trump had gone and put his arm around one of the family members and said, "We all hear you now." You know what
and
I mean?
Meant it.
Meant it. Yeah. It would have changed the dynamics of this entire situation. It would have been a unifying moment because everybody universally knows what happened to George Floyd was wrong. Everybody. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody that's like, "Well, that guy probably got what." No, nobody said that,
Right. Yeah, right. And instead, he politicized it like he did, like he's done so many things heading up until now. And it's, we could have a whole segment on that, but
yeah, well, we could also do a whole segment on the guy who's been living in his basement on your side of the aisle too, sniffing people's hair, but whatever. It's all good. No, I do agree with you on that. I really wish he had done that in that moment. I think it would have changed a lot of the way this summer has gone for the better.
There are things that are required of the American president. Mm-hmm. I'm not watching really TV much at all these days because I have 3 kids and 2 jobs and my wife works full time. But I was just exhausted when I this week and I sat down and was swimming through it. And on PBS, there was a thing on Clinton. And Clinton is really, again, I'm dating myself, but Clinton is kind of the first American president for me where I was old enough to have a better understanding of what was going on, right? You know,
Sure.
I was 8 when H.W. Bush got elected. So, you know,
we're pretty close in age then, because the first vote, my first vote was for Bob Dole. Well, 1996, that was my first vote for president.
Yeah, and see, my first vote was in 2000. So, okay. You know, we're close, right?
Yep.
So I say Clinton was I was never actually even able to vote for Clinton because I was not old enough.
Right.
But he was sort of the first president where I was old enough to understand a few of the things they were talking about. You know, when they talked about Bosnia, I could find it by myself on a map,
yeah.
Right? You know, those are the things you could do.
Right.
You know, but I didn't realize how many stumbles or didn't remember how many stumbles he had.
Right.
But they pointed on this thing on PBS to Clinton, where he went to Oklahoma City after the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
And he stood there in the room with all the families, and they had all the family, you know, there are 100 and some odd people and federal government workers killed. I mean, this devastated this community. Right. And he went there and he brought everyone together, regardless of everything else that was going on at the time with his feud with Newt Gingrich, real policy differences, real style differences.
Yeah.
And he put that aside and went and he acted like the American president.
Right.
George W. Bush, despite the 2000 election and all the acrimony and all of the division, which we saw, which happens in politics, on September 12th, went and put his arm around a New York City fire chief and said, "I'm the American president," right? Donald Trump has never had that moment, and Lord knows he's had opportunities.
My problem or my fear is, this is a total different conversation from the police thing, but it's interesting nonetheless to me. My fear is that we're never going to have that again. Because I look at the choices this year, and you're probably going to vote for Biden. You know, whatever. It's cool. It's just, this is our choice. And then in 2016, that was our choice. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
No,
my fear is that we're never going to – I hope there's some kind of pendulum swing here where we come back to some sense of normalcy. I agree with a lot of what President Trump has done. I've defended him a lot in certain areas. But I've also been – for people that get mad at me when I criticize Trump, I join the crowd, because I've also been very intellectually honest about him from time to time. When I disagree with him, I disagree with him, and I let people know that I disagree with him. I don't care. I'll do that with any president. But I kind of fear that the presidential people are afraid to run. This goes back to my conversation about police, right? We're getting the government we deserve. We're always going to be stuck now with social media presidents. We're going to get the government we deserve, because that's how we run business in America. If you're a good person, you look at what happens to somebody in politics, and it's like, hell no, I'm not running and putting my family through that. So we're self-fulfilling our disaster here, because the really good states people, that's what we need, is a states person, you know, someone who doesn't necessarily get in there and say, all in for the Democratic agenda or all in for the Republican agenda. We need somebody who gets in and says, I'm all in for the American agenda. You know what I mean? And I fear we're not going to see that again in our lifetime. I don't know. Maybe I'm pessimistic.
I do. And look, I find someone, I expect a Republican or a Democratic president to be a member of their party.
Sure.
Right. I'm not
you
saying
push the
that
agenda.
You should have someone,
yeah.
Right. We should. And they're a member of that. Oftentimes they're a member of that party for a reason.
Right.
Right. Because there is some value system and belief articulated through that to which they adhere. But I say this without any sense of irony, sarcasm, humor. I hope you're wrong.
And I hope I am too. I do.
Right. I deeply hope you're wrong, because, and what do you think it is? I mean, I was like, you were saying that, and I was thinking back, you know, we've had very good people run. I mean, even going back to the 2012 election, as recently as 2012, you have Barack Obama, Ivy League educated, first African-American president, you know, steered through some difficult times, running against Mitt Romney, you know, himself an incredible legacy of public service,
right.
Incredible education, business, you know, exploits, whether you agree with them or disagree with them, their resumes were incredibly impressive, and people who were devoted to public service.
Yep.
What has happened, do you think?
240 characters.
Is it social media? Yeah.
240 characters. Because here's the thing. We've just gone, we're at an hour and 13 minutes. We have had significant disagreement in this conversation. My guess is I'm 99% sure when we hang up the phone, we're still friends. Right. You cannot do that in 240 characters. You can't nuance a conversation. Look, I've learned some things from talking to you today. Doesn't mean you've convinced me. It means I understand your perspective a little bit more than I did before we started this conversation. You cannot do that. Yesterday, I'll give you a perfect example. Yesterday, I posted a tweet. Elon Musk, the astronauts came back down to Earth, landed safely, first space flight in 10 years. And I post and I retweeted, and guess what I put? I put hashtag capitalism. Okay. Very simplistic analysis. Understood. Mm-hmm. Very simplistic analysis of what happened there. But then somebody comes back and they're like, immediately, you know, you're a clown. This is, you're not taking into account the socialistic tax breaks that he got. It's just bullcrap. You know, and then I kind of responded, and then I was like, this is pointless, right? It's obviously what Elon Musk has done is nuanced, right? In this case, the government was not capable of doing what he did as cheaply as he did it. Yes, they gave him some subsidies. Perhaps some I might have argued against. But in the end, capitalism, freedom, profit motive, that drove innovation and went into space. Okay, you probably would agree with that statement because you understand the nuance of it in a conversation like this. But in a Twitter, all you get is, you're a clown, right? When you have, when as a society, we're like literally starting to gauge, and what's weird is only 2% of people are actually active on Twitter, but it literally stamps itself all over our society. You can destroy somebody's entire life and livelihood on Twitter in 2 minutes. And that, I think, is part of why we're never going to have that type of president again, because everything is done in soundbite. You mentioned earlier, I don't want to boil this down to a soundbite. It's not fair to boil it down to a soundbite. And yet that's how we live our lives. And the media sort of, I think, it amplifies that on all sides of the media as well. Talk radio. I cried, the greatest thing that ever happened to me was getting out of it full time for a little while just to step back, you know, because when you're in something, you have a perspective of it. And then when you step back, you have a different perspective of it. You know, and it's more nuanced. I think that's part of the problem. Yeah.
I think you're right. Even, you know, you talk about Twitter, it's how we amplify it even through other media. You know, we have the morning news on every morning in our house, right? It's just on, even if it's in the background, it's on, to the point where my youngest daughter, who just turned 2 last Thursday, when the Today Show comes on and says, you know, live from Rockefeller Plaza in New York City,
right?
This is Today, and they go with Savannah Guthrie, and she goes, and oh, copy, is how she said it. She goes, oh, copy, right? I mean, so she can just say it,
I
right?
Love it. That's awesome.
And so we have the news on, but you'll see, okay, even the Today Show will all of a sudden say, and the reaction on Twitter states this.
Right.
You have no idea if they have vetted that person on Twitter at all. If one, are they a real person?
Yeah. Yeah.
Two, do they have 36 followers and know anything about the subject?
Right.
To which they're speaking, right? You know, I mean, this is like, yeah. It's wild. And
yeah.
It's, I mean, I'm
now, and I also think I think the other problem is that compounds it is we now have a right wing and left wing media. We don't have a media. You know, there's not really very many people that are in the business of journalism that don't have an agenda of one side or the other. And so as a result of that, this is why we amplify those kinds of voices like, oh, well, Twitter says, you know. So when you go, well, if I'm watching CNN, I'm clearly getting the Democrat perspective. And if I'm watching Fox, I'm clearly getting the Republican perspective. And I mean, it's not even hidden anymore. It's like hardcore. You know, it's I think that is a huge part of it too, because what they'll do then is they'll do attack takedown pieces, right? We're going to take down, you know, this great Democrat. There were some really good Democrats that were running in 2016 and Hillary got it. Like, really? You know what I mean? And same with, like, there was an all-star panel of Republicans in 2016. And I always get a
I think it actually was every Republican ran in 2016.
I think so. Every single one. Yeah. Every single one. Well, I always get a kick out of, like, Joe Scarborough always complaining about Trump. And I'm like, you people put him in that place. I'm like, you do realize this. I've said this all the way from the beginning. The media thought that the easiest guy to beat would be Trump. And Joe Scarborough, I remember, like, literally watching it. Like, Trump would be on the phone with Scarborough and Mika 3 days a week during the primary. And they were loving it. They were yucking it up and having a good time and yada, yada, yada. And then as soon as Trump wins the primary, like, oh, my God, Russia. You know, it was like, I was like, you people put him in place because you thought he was going to be an easy beat. That was all agenda driven, you know. And, of course, the American people had a different idea. But again, it's going back to this point that where on one side, the mainstream media was like, let's put this crazy guy in here because it'll be easy to beat. And then we'll promote this crazy woman over here and she'll be the president. And it's like, we got a bad choice. There were other great options on the Democratic side too, you know.
You've given me so much to unpack. I don't want my Democrats to think I'm standing up for us over here. But I will get in one slight dig before going
go
to
for
the
it.
Larger point. Which the slight dig, as you said, the American people thought differently. Now, the Electoral College.
Okay, all right. Fair point. Definitely
went a different direction.
Fair point.
You know, one of the problems I see in the coverage, and I do agree there's a problem in the coverage. I mean, keep in mind, I actually was a journalism major in undergrad and worked briefly for a local news station, KOMU NBC8 in Columbia, Missouri. So I come at this from a place of, I want to see journalism and news be the thing I believe in my heart it should be, the fourth estate.
Right. Yes.
Which does not show, I mean, there's going to be bias.
There's going to be bias, but doesn't show, fairness. Shows
it doesn't
fairness.
Show, yeah, it doesn't show courier favor to one party or another. And that is, do you know what Democrats and Republicans both have in common?
Lay it on
me. Some might argue this, but you and I can agree. Democrats and Republicans are both made up of humans.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And humans make mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's it. I mean, the way I was raised and the way I believe, and even if you can go to, you can take this from an anthropological standpoint, a scientific standpoint, or even a theological standpoint.
Right. Right.
Humans are imperfect.
Yeah.
That's what we are. We're not perfect.
Yep.
And they make mistakes.
And I think
have sinned and fallen short of the glory. And so what I think is that one of the problems is with this coverage we're seeing, where they're not hiding anymore, whether that it's agenda driven and one side is Republican or one side is Democrat, they are also not acknowledging the mistakes of their own party.
Right.
And right. You're fortifying people into believing one side is always right, one yep. side is always wrong. And that does, I think, diminish the dialogue.
It tribalizes us.
And it can be an ardent supporter of a party, mm-hmm. right? You can be an ardent supporter of a party, or a yellow dog Democrat or a yellow dog Republican, whatever you want to say, right? You can be an ardent supporter, but still understand we're humans. We make mistakes. Some things work, some things don't. You should be able to look at something and whether it's a Democrat or a Republican idea, say, hey, you know what? That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And that seems to be missing right now.
But, you know, when we get away from social media, we can mostly do that. I think most Americans are not that far apart. You know, when I'm out and about in public, I don't not get along with people.
That's right.
You know,
no, I mean,
but to your point, too, about journalism, I remember when I first started, I was in journalism, not commentary. And I was working in a network newsroom, and my boss was a guy that had been in the business forever. He was a big liberal. We're friends to this day. He knew I was conservative. I was the only conservative in the newsroom. I respected everybody in this newsroom, despite the fact that I was the only conservative, because you couldn't tell it. But yeah. He came up to me and he said one day, he goes, Leland, I know you're conservative. He goes, and I know you're going to have biases. Don't worry about it. He said, everybody has biases. What I expect mm-hmm. from you, what I demand from you and everyone else in this newsroom is fairness. And yeah. that stuck with me. Forever, because that I respected that so much, because he had an mm-hmm. understanding of human condition. We're biased. We all have the way how we were brought up frames our worldview. But what yes. we can all be, because like you said, we're all humans, is we can all be fair, or at least strive to be, you know.
It's try to be fair and open. You know, I think going back to what we're talking today about, we're supposed to talk today about police reform.
Yeah, I know.
But underpinning the police reform is a long overdue, honest conversation about race in this country, mm-hmm. right? And the systemic oppression, systemic racism that has existed for too long. But, you know, one of the things I see, and you talk about social media, is people labeling someone a racist. And this goes back. I had a wonderful conversation with a guy in the Pan-African Studies Department at U of L. And we were talking about this. This is a couple of years ago. And he said, to your point, all of us have biases. All of us can even have racial bias, whether it's destructive or even could be something that you might consider a good quality, right?
Right.
But all of us have bias. All of us have racial bias. All of us have some even racial insensitivity. Mm-hmm. It's when confronted with that, how you internalize it and approach it.
Right.
Right. So if someone confronts and says, this is why this is hurtful, this is why this is harmful, and you're listening and you're understanding, you're trying to do better, right, then that's someone you can work with and talk to. Now, if somebody who just says, no, I don't care what you say at all, and I like it this way, that's probably someone who's a racist.
Right, right,
you know?
Right.
But it's, like you said, we all have these biases. And when you go to news coverage, the story, I don't even know what it is today because I haven't looked at the physical paper. I read it online. Whatever story is the front page above the fold today in the Courier Journal shows a bias. Mm-hmm. It shows a bias of what those news reporters and editors think is the most important story in Louisville today.
Yeah.
Not that the coverage itself is biased, right? Just that's a bias in and of itself.
Right.
Doesn't make that bias bad. It's hopefully made by, you know, informed news people who are following all the events of the community and have an understanding of what's important. And so, like you said, the bias is always going to be there, but we've got to get back to more of the fairness. And the way I will say this, simply saying you're fair and balanced does not make you fair and balanced.
No. Simply saying you're fact-based does not mean you're fact-based. There, you got your dig at Fox. I got my dig at CNN.
There you go.
Because you're my guest, I'm going to give you the last word. We do agree a lot on police reform. Is there anything, and we didn't talk about it much, even though that was the intended goal today. But I'm sorry, but this is one of the I don't know how people are going to react to this, but this is going to go on my list of probably top five fun conversations that I've had, because the goal here, again, I think, is to hear a different point of view. You know, I can always have my conservative friends on anytime I want, and we can wax poetic about how wrong you are about certain things. But actually, you know, it's educational to learn and to get another perspective. And then there's really, I think the thing I take away from this conversation the most is that, yes, there were clearly differences in worldview, but we're not that far apart in the sense that we do recognize the same problems. And I think if everybody could sort of get to that place and realize that we are all concerned about a lot of the same problems, then we could have a lot more constructive solution to it. But I want to give you the last word on police reform. Is there anything we missed that you also want to maybe hit that you think is low-lying fruit that we could get in terms of police reform that could make things better?
I'm trying to make this shift after the conversation we've just had. I mean, we talked about, we've got to end no-knock warrants.
Right. Agreed.
We need to require body cameras. We need to ban the chokeholds that we've talked about. We need an empowered civilian review board. And we need to look at more community-based policing. We ask police officers to do so much more now than we ever have before. If you're in a little fender bender, you call the cops. Mm-hmm. If you're in, if you're a business downtown, I've seen this because I work downtown in downtown Louisville or in the Highlands, the area I represent, and there's a homeless person in front of your business who probably needs help, right? Oftentimes the police are called, and then it's not just one officer, it's two officers. Now all of a sudden the officers are handling a problem where, quite frankly, our social services should step in. There's a great article outlining what happened in Alexandria in Northern Kentucky. And they didn't have enough money to hire another officer, so they hired a social worker to work directly with the Alexandria Police Department in Kentucky, Northern Kentucky, a conservative place. It worked so well that instead of hiring another officer when they got more money, they hired a second social worker, right, to handle some of these problems. I'll give you an example of a problem. I won't tell my relationship with her, but an elderly woman whom I know very, very well, and her husband is battling Parkinson's and dementia, is in an assisted living facility right now, which is obviously very difficult during COVID. Toilet started spewing water the other day. She's living alone. And called a neighbor over finally to help her, and he's got the shop vac out and wearing a mask because she's an elderly woman. She's covered the area so much up with towels, he doesn't see that she hasn't turned the water off. She calls 911. Mm-hmm. Right? All they had to do was turn the little water off on the back of the toilet.
Right.
But 911 was called.
Right.
Right. You know what I mean? So these are problems. We are taxing our police force to do those types of things. We've got to look at better, more effective policing across the board and not label someone as soft or tough on crime or going to these political labels. But again, criminal justice reform has always been an area where we could come together, because I think we all agree we want the same thing.
Right.
We want everyone, and I mean everyone, whether you're white, black, brown, male, female, indifferent, right? We want everyone to be safe.
Yeah.
And so how do we do that in the most effective way possible?
Do you think we would be better off asking, instead of defunding the police, could we shift some of the funds that are going in the justice system that to more rehabilitation-based expenditures rather than incarceration-based expenditures? Like, I think,
you're gonna take us into the third hour of this program.
Yeah, I know. Can I just invite you back? Can I just invite you back? Yes, can we do another episode? You know, because there might be some more stuff we can glean from this that would be worth talking about.
You can absolutely invite me back. And look, I don't want to be the tone police.
Right.
I mean, I think part of the reason we're having these honest conversations is because people are using language that makes others pay attention.
Yeah.
Right. And so what we've got to do is so much of what we've talked about. I mean, again, we've put healthcare off. We've put most of the poverty conversation. We focused a little bit on housing. Now we've got to do some of the more actual criminal justice reform, which there is a big interplay with criminal justice reform and police reform.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you have this conversation even without having the bail reform conversation?
Right.
Where we're putting people in jail because of their economic status. Right.
Right.
And if you don't have $500, but you're not a risk to the community and you're not a flight risk, you're still sitting in jail.
Right.
So I mean, there's a lot of different aspects to this, but we have to do a better job of saying, let's look at this from the lens of agreement.
Right.
We want everyone to be safe.
Right.
I don't want someone who, if they're going to be out of jail, is going to walk down the street and brutalize an 8-year-old little girl, which is what happened in the Kane Madden situation in Louisville.
Yeah.
Right. We don't want that.
Right.
That doesn't mean we can't look at mental health reform, criminal justice reform, bail reform in general. Right. And so we've got to get to a point where we can say, let's do this. I think those are steps on police reform where we're going to find broad based agreement.
Right.
And we need to be looking at those. And then, you know, I think we also have to be looking into some of the policeman's bill of rights. Why can't we have a civilian review board with subpoena power? You know, there's one provision in there. The Policeman's Bill of Rights is in statute. I think it's KRS 15520. I can say that on a podcast because if I'm wrong, you know, I apologize. I think that's where it is in the statutes. But, you know, if you're a police officer who is going to be accused of committing a crime while on duty, you cannot be interrogated until 48 hours after you've been served with written notice of the allegations.
Right.
Imagine if the rest of us got treated that way.
Right? Yeah.
You don't get interrogated until 48 hours after you've gotten written notice.
Yeah. You can.
Not just that you know it's happening.
You can demand a lawyer and they can usually put it off 48 hours. But if you don't have enough money for bail, you'll sit in jail that entire time.
Not to mention, you have all the allegations in writing in front of you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I think that might be a conversation, like you said, for another day. But I did promise to give you the last word on that, and I do think there's a lot of agreement on the police reform that we've found. This has been a fun conversation, Senator McGarvey. I appreciate it. What I realized is we started talking, and I never actually properly introduced you, so I'll have to put that in the pre-recorded intro to the conversation. So.
That's okay. I'm happy to be on. I enjoy this conversation. I enjoy the format of going longer, even though we went down a lot of different tangents and left some loose ends unresolved.
Yes, no doubt.
Certainly, it's good to get those points out there, and always happy to come back.
Well, I think people will forgive us for leaving loose ends unresolved, because that's the point of a conversation. You can't finish it all in one setting. So, Well, I also am hungry for pie since we had a long conversation about that. Listen, thank you very much for being on with us today. We appreciate it. We're going to have you back. We'll talk more, okay?
And sounds good.
By the way, you just missed by 2.5 minutes being the new longest episode of the Disruption Zone. 136 is the longest, so you missed it by 2.5 minutes. But you're number two. So
number two.
Have a great day. Talk to you later.
All right, thanks, Leon. Talk to you soon.
All right. I honestly had no intention of talking for an hour and 33 minutes today, and that was awesome. I enjoyed every bit of it. Look, don't agree with everything he said. Agree with some of it. Saw perspective, understood perspective I hadn't quite understood before. Understanding perspective doesn't mean I'm convinced. It means I understand the perspective. I really, truly believe this, and I think I heard this maybe on Joe Rogan's podcast, and yeah, I reference it a lot because I listen to it. I recommend you add that to your listens for sure. He's a lefty, although frankly, I think he's a conservative and doesn't know it. He's a liberty lover, and I think he often aligns with the left until he understands something, and then when he understands something, he goes, oh, wait, okay. Anyway, the point is, the guy's a great conversationalist, and he has, I think, the kinds of conversations that we need to have more of in America. And this is me doing my little part, but one of the things that really stuck with me from his podcast was that, you know, we have to understand the perspective of those with whom we're debating. And if you don't understand the perspective, your debate will be completely ineffectual. So, yeah, we left a lot of loose ends today. There's clearly disagreement between me and Senator McGarvey. But I hope that you got the same sort of helpful understanding of the perspective that he comes from for when you're having these conversations with your friends and family. And maybe that in that sense, maybe we advanced the ball a little bit. So it's just a conversation, people. It's just a conversation. Hey, thank you for listening. We're getting thousands of downloads a week, which is really remarkable, and I love that. It's a free podcast. It's a free download, so please share it with your family and friends. You can do that. It's at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and iHeartRadio. Just go to the iHeartRadio app and search The Disruption Zone. Thanks to my co-producer and co-executive producer and co-host, Cameron Mills, who will be back with us soon, I promise. Thanks to JP Web Design, and thanks also to Dynamics Productions Audio in Lexington, Kentucky, for their help with the program. Follow us on Instagram. It's at GreatlyLondo and at The Disruption Zone. And on Twitter, it's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.